about Granny. She stands in silence next to Alf and blinks until her head hurts. Alf tries to look unconcerned, but Elsa notices that he's scanning the darkness, as if looking for someone. He watches their surroundings much like Wolfheart and the worse, as if he's also on guard duty. She squints and tries to fit him into Granny's life like a piece of a puzzle. She can't recall Granny ever talking very much about him, except that he never knew how to lift his feet, which was why the soles of his shoes were always so worn down.
"How well did you know Granny?" she asks.
The leather jacket creaks.
"What do you mean, knew? We were bloody neighbours, that's all," Alf answers evasively.
"So what did you mean when you picked me up in the taxi when you said Granny would never have forgiven you if you'd left me there?"
More creaking.
"I didn't mean anything. Not a bloody... nothing. I just happened to be in the area. Bloody..."
He sounds frustrated. Elsa nods, pretending to understand in a way that Alf clearly doesn't appreciate at all.
"Why are you here, then?" she asks, teasingly.
"What?"
"Why did you follow me outside? Shouldn't you be driving your taxi now or something?"
"You don't have a bloody... You don't have exclusive rights to taking walks, you know?"
"Sure, sure."
"I can't let you and the mutt run loose here at night on your own. Your granny would have blo—"
He interrupts himself, grunts, sighs.
"Your granny would never have forgiven me if something happened to you."
It looks as if he already regrets saying that.
"Did you and Granny have an affair?"
Elsa asks, after waiting for what seems a more than adequate length of time. Alf looks like she just threw a yellow snowball in his face.
"Aren't you a bit young to know what that means?"
"There are loads of things I'm too young to know about, but I know about them anyway."
She clears her throat and carries on.
"Once when I was small, Mum was going to explain what her work was because I'd asked Dad and he didn't really seem to know. And then Mum said she worked as an economist. And then I said, 'What?' And then she said, 'I'll work out how much money the hospital has so we know what we can buy.' And then I said, 'What, like in a shop?' And then she said that, 'Yeah, sort of like in a shop. And it wasn't hard to get it at all, and so really Dad was being a bit thick about it.'"
Alf checks his watch.
"But then, anyway, I saw a TV series where two people had a shop. They were also having an affair, or at least I think they did. So now I get what it means, sort of thing, and I thought that was kind of how you and Granny knew each other. So, did you, or didn't you?"
"Is that mutt done now, or what? Some of us have jobs to go to?"
Alf mutters, which isn't much of an answer. He turns towards the bushes. Elsa scrutinizes him, thoughtfully.
"I just thought you could be Granny's type, because you're a bit younger than she is, and she always flirted with policemen who were about your age. They were sort of too old to be policemen, but they were still policemen. Not that you're a policeman, I mean, but you're also old without being really old. Get what I mean?"
Alf doesn't look like he really gets it, and he looks like he's got a bit of a migraine. The worse finishes, and the three of them head back inside, Elsa in the middle. It's not a big army.
"But it's an army," thinks Elsa, and feels a little less afraid of the dark.
When they part ways in the cellar between the door to the garage and the door to the storage units, Elsa scrapes her shoe against the floor and asks Alf,
"What was that music you were listening to in the car when you came to pick me up? Was it opera?"
"Holy Christ, enough questions!
I was only asking. Bloody...
yay! It was a bastard opera!"
"What language was it in?"
"Italian."
"Can you talk Italian?"
"Yeah."
"For real?"
"What other bloody way is there to know Italian?"
"But, like, fluently?"
"You have to find another hiding place for that thing, I told you," he says, gesturing at the worse,
clearly trying to change the subject.
"People will find it sooner or later."
"Do you know Italian or not?"
"I know enough to understand an opera. You got any other bastard questions?"
"What was that opera about in the car, then?" she persists.
Alf pulls open the garage door.
"Love. They're all about love. The whole lot."
He pronounces the word love a little as one would say words like white goods or two-inch screw.
Were you in love with my granny then?
Elsa yells after him, but he's already slammed the door. She stays there grinning. The worst does too. She's almost sure about that, and it's much more difficult being afraid of shadows and the dark while grinning.
I think Alf is our friend now,
she whispers. The worse looks like it agrees.
We're going to need all the friends we can get, because Granny didn't tell me what happens in this fairy tale.
The worse snuggles up against her.
I miss Wolfheart,
Elsa whispers into its fur. Reluctantly, the worse seems to agree with that too. Chapter 20. Clothes Shop. Today's the day, and it starts with the most terrible night. Elsa wakes with her mouth wide open, but her scream fills her head rather than the room. She roars silently and reaches out with her hand to toss aside the bedclothes, but they're already on the floor. She walks into the flat. It smells of eggs. George smiles carefully at her from the kitchen. She doesn't smile back. He looks upset. She doesn't care. She has a shower so hot her skin feels as if it's about to come away from her flesh like clementine peel. Walks out into the flat. Mum left home hours ago. She's gone to fix everything because that is what Mum does. George calls out something behind Elsa, but she neither listens nor answers. She puts on the clothes that Mum has put out for her and crosses the landing, locking the front door behind her. Granny's flat smells wrong. It smells clean. The towers of removal boxes throw shadows across the hall like monuments to everything that is now absent. She stands inside the door, incapable of going any further inside. She was here last night, but it's more difficult by daylight. It's harder work remembering things when the sun is forcing its way in through the blinds. Cloud animals soar past in the sky. It's a beautiful morning, but a terrible day. Elsa's skin is still burning after her shower. It makes her think of Granny, because Granny's shower hadn't worked in over a year, and instead of calling the landlord and asking him to sort out the problem, she just used Mum and George's shower. And sometimes she forgot to do up her dressing gown when she went back through the flat. And sometimes she forgot her dressing gown altogether. Once, Mum shouted at her for what must have been 15 minutes because she didn't show any respect about George also living in Mum and Elsa's flat. But that was soon after Elsa had started reading the collected works of Charles Dickens. Granny was not much use at reading books, so Elsa used to read them to her while they were driving Renault, because Elsa wanted to have someone she could discuss them with afterwards. Especially A Christmas Carol, which Elsa had read several times, because Granny liked Christmas stories. So when Mum said that thing about how Granny shouldn't run about naked in the flat out of respect to George, then Granny, still naked, turned to George and said, "What's all this respect rubbish? You're cohabiting with my daughter, for goodness sake." And then Granny bowed very deeply and very nakedly and added ceremoniously, "I am the spirit of future Christmases, George." Mum was very angry at Granny about that, but she tried not to show it for Elsa's sake. So for Mum's sake, Elsa tried not to show how proud she was of Granny for being able to quote Charles Dickens. Elsa goes into the flat without taking off her shoes. She's wearing the kind of shoes that scratch the parquet flooring, so Mum has told her she can't wear them inside. But it doesn't matter in Granny's place because the floor already looks as if someone went skating on it. Partly because it's old and partly because Granny actually once went skating on it. Elsa opens the door of the big wardrobe. The worse licks her face. It smells of protein bars and sponge cake mix. Elsa had just gone to bed last night when she realized that Mum would most likely send George down to the cellar storage unit today to get the spare chairs, because everyone is coming here afterwards for coffee. Because today is the day, and everyone drinks coffee somewhere after days like this. Mum and George's cellar unit is next to Granny's unit, and it's the only storage unit you can see the worse from now that Alf has put up the plywood sheets. So Elsa sneaked down in the night, unable to decide whether she was more afraid of shadows or ghosts or Brit Marie, and brought the worse upstairs.
There would be more space to hide you in here if Granny wasn't dead,
says Elsa apologetically, because then the wardrobe wouldn't have stopped growing.
Then again, if Granny hadn't died, you wouldn't need to hide in the first place.
The Wurst licks her face again and squeezes its head through the opening and looks for her backpack. Elsa runs to fetch it from the hall and pulls out 3 tins of dreams and 1 litre of milk.
Maud left them with Mum last night,
Elsa explains, but when the Wurst immediately starts snuffling her hands as if about to eat the biscuits with the tin still round them, she raises an admonishing forefinger.
You can only have 2 tins. One is for ammunition.
The Wurst barks at her a bit about that, but in the end recognizes its poor bargaining position and only polishes off 2 of the tins and 1/2 of the 3rd. It is a Wurst, after all, and these are biscuits. Elsa takes the milk and goes looking for her moo gun. She's a bit slow on the uptake today. Because she hasn't had any nightmares in years, she's only realizing now that she may need it. The first time the shadow came to her in the nightmare, she tried to shake it all off the next morning, as you do, tried to persuade herself that it was only a nightmare. But she should have known better, because everyone who has ever been in the land of almost awake knows better. So last night, when she had the same dream, she realized where she had to go to fight the nightmares, to reclaim her nights from them.
Meravis!
She calls out firmly to the Wurst when it comes out of one of Granny's smaller wardrobes, followed by an unnameable jumble of things that Mum has not yet had time to put into boxes.
We have to go to Meravis,
announces Elsa to the Wurst, waving her moo gun. Meravis, one of the kingdoms adjoining Miamis, is the smallest principality in the land of Almost Awake, and for that reason, almost forgotten. When children in the land of Almost Awake are learning geography and have to reel off the names of the 6 kingdoms, Meravis is the one they always forget, even those who live there, because the Meravasians are incredibly humble, kindly, and cautious creatures who go to great lengths to avoid taking up unnecessary space or causing the slightest inconvenience. Yet they have a very important task. Actually, one of the most important tasks in a kingdom where imagination is the most important thing you can have. For it is in Meravis that the nightmare hunters are trained. Only smart asses in the real world who don't know any better would say something as idiotic as, "It was only a nightmare." There are no only nightmares. They're living creatures, dark, little clouds of insecurity and anguish that come sneaking between the houses when everyone is asleep, trying all the doors and windows to find some place to slip inside and start causing a commotion. And that is why there are nightmare hunters, and anyone who knows anything about anything knows one has to have a moo gun to chase a nightmare. Someone who doesn't know better might mistake a moo gun for a quite ordinary paintball gun customized by someone's granny with a milk carton at the side and a catapult glued to the top. Elsa, though, knows what she's got in her hands. She loads the carton with milk and puts a biscuit in the firing chamber in front of the rubber band on the biscuit gun. You can't kill a nightmare, but you can scare it. And there's nothing so feared by nightmares as milk and biscuits. Just as she's starting to feel more confident, though, she's startled by the doorbell, and to the infinite chagrin of the Wurst, she accidentally fires loads of milk at it, but no biscuit, and it scurries off in a huff. For a moment, she wonders how a nightmare can be ringing the doorbell, but it's only George. He looks upset. She doesn't care.
I'm going down to pick up the spare chairs in the cellar storage, he says, and tries to smile at her, like stepdads do on days when they have an extra strong sense of being sidelined.
Elsa shrugs and slams the door in his face. The Wurst has reappeared, so she climbs onto its back and peers out of the spy hole to see George lingering there for what must be a minute, looking upset. Elsa hates him for that. Mum always tells Elsa that George just wants her to like him because he cares. As if Elsa doesn't get that. She knows he cares, and that's why she can't like him. Not because she wouldn't like him if she tried, but rather because she knows she definitely would.
Because everyone likes George. It's his superpower.
And she knows that in this case, she'll only be disappointed when Halfie is born, and George forgets she exists. It's better not to like him from the start.
If you don't like people, they can't hurt you.
Almost 8-year-olds who are often described as different learn that very quickly. She jumps down from the worse's back. The worse closes its jaws round the moo gun and gently but firmly takes it away from her, then shambles off and puts it on a stool out of reach of her trigger finger. But it avoids eating the biscuit, which, as anyone who understands just how much worses love biscuits, is a significant sign of respect for Elsa. There's another ring at the door. Elsa throws it open and is just about to snap impatiently at George when she realizes just in time that it's not George. There's a silence lasting for probably half a dozen eternities.
"Hello, Elsa," says the woman in the black skirt, sounding a bit lost.
She's wearing jeans, not a black skirt today, admittedly, and she smells of mint and looks scared. She breathes so slowly that Elsa fears she's about to expire from a shortage of oxygen.
I'm very sorry I shouted at you in my office," she begins.
They scrutinize each other's shoes.
"It's cool," Elsa manages to say at last.
The corners of the woman's mouth vibrate gently.
"I was a bit caught off guard when you came to the office. I don't get many people visiting me there. I'm not so good at visits."
Elsa nods guiltily without looking up from the woman's shoes.
"It doesn't matter. Sorry for saying that about..."
She whispers, unable to get out the last few words. The woman waves her hand dismissively.
"It was my fault. It's difficult for me to talk about my family. Your grandmother tried to make me do it, but it only made me, well, angry."
Elsa pokes at the floor with the tip of her toe.
"People drink wine to forget things that are hard, right?
Or to have the strength to remember, I think."
Elsa snuffles. "You're also broken, right? Like Wolfheart."
"Broken in another way, maybe."
"Couldn't you mend yourself, then?"
"You mean because I'm a psychologist?"
Elsa nods.
"Doesn't that work?"
"I don't think surgeons can operate on themselves. It's probably more or less the same thing."
Elsa nods again. For an instant, the woman in the jeans looks as if she's about to reach out towards her, but she stops herself and absent-mindedly scratches the palm of her hand instead.
"Your granny wrote in the letter that she wanted me to look after you," she whispers.
Elsa nods.
"That's what she writes in all the letters, apparently."
"You sound angry."
"She didn't write any letters to me."
The woman reaches into a bag on the floor and gets something out.
I bought these Harry Potter books yesterday. I haven't had time to get very far yet, but, you know."
"What made you change your mind?"
I understand Harry Potter is important to you."
"Harry Potter is important for everyone."
The skin around the woman's mouth cracks again. She takes another long, deep breath. Looks into Elsa's eyes and says,
"I like him a lot, too. That's what I wanted to say. It's been a long time since I had such an amazing reading experience. You almost never do once you grow up. Things are at their peak when you're a child, and then it's all downhill from there. Well, because of the cynicism, I suppose, I just wanted to thank you for reminding me of how things used to be."
Those are more words than Elsa has ever heard the woman say without stuttering. The woman offers her what's in the bag. Elsa takes it. It's also a book. A fairy tale. The Brothers Lionheart by Astrid Lindgren. Elsa knows that because it's one of her favourite stories that doesn't come from the land of Almost Awake. She read it aloud to Granny many times while they were driving around in Renault. It's about Carl and Jonathan, who die and come to Nangi Yala, where they have to fight the tyrant, Tengil, and the dragon, Katla. The woman's gaze loses its footing again.
I used to read it to my boys when their granny died. I don't know if you've read it. You probably have.
Elsa shakes her head and holds the book tightly.
No.
She lies, because she's polite enough to know that if someone gives you a book, you owe that person the pretense that you haven't read it. The woman in jeans looks relieved. Then she takes such a deep breath that Elsa fears her wishbone is about to snap.
You know, you asked if we met at the hospital, your granny and I. After the tsunami, They had laid out all the dead bodies in a little square, so families and friends could look for their... After I mean, she found me there, in the square. I had been sitting there for, I don't know, several weeks, I think. She flew me home and she said I could live here until I knew where I was going.
Her lips open and close in turn as if they're electric.
I just stayed here. I just stayed.
Elsa looks down at her own shoes this time.
Are you coming today? She asks.
In the corner of her eye, she can see the woman shaking her head, as if she wants to run away again.
I don't think I think your grandmother was very disappointed in me.
Maybe she was disappointed in you because you're so disappointed in yourself.
There's a choking sound in the woman's throat. It takes a while before Elsa understands it's probably laughter, as if that part of her throat had been in disuse and has just found the key to itself and flicked some old electrical switch.
You're really a very different little child, says the woman.
I'm not a little child. I'm almost 8.
Yes, sorry. You were a newborn when I moved in here. Newborn?
There's nothing wrong with being different. Granny said that only different people change the world.
Yes, sorry, I have to go. I just wanted to say... sorry.
It's okay. Thanks for the book.
The woman's eyes hesitate, but she looks straight at Elsa again.
Has your friend come back? Wolf, what was it you called him?
Elsa shakes her head. There's something in the woman's eyes that actually looks like genuine concern.
He does that sometimes. Disappears. You shouldn't worry. He gets scared of people, disappears for a while, but he always comes back. He just needs time.
I think he needs help.
It's hard to help those who don't want to help themselves.
Someone who wants to help himself is possibly not the one who's most in need of other people's help,
Elsa objects. The woman nods without answering.
I have to go, she repeats.
Elsa wants to stop her, but she's already halfway down the stairs. She's almost disappeared on the floor below when Elsa leans over the railing, gathers her strength, and calls out.
Did you find them? Did you find your boys in the square?
The woman stops, holds the banister very hard.
Yes.
Elsa bites her lip.
Do you believe in life after death?
The woman looks up at her.
That's a difficult question.
I mean, you know, do you believe in God?
Asks Elsa.
Sometimes it's hard to believe in God, answers the woman.
Because you wonder why God didn't stop the tsunami?
Because I wonder why there are tsunamis at all.
Elsa nods.
I saw someone in a film once say, faith can move mountains,
Elsa goes on without knowing why, maybe mainly because she doesn't want to lose sight of the woman before she has time to ask the question she really wants to ask.
So I hear, says the woman.
Elsa shakes her head.
But you know, that's actually true, because it comes from Miamis, from a giant called Faith. She was so strong it was insane, and she could literally move mountains.
The woman looks as if she's trying to find a reason to disappear down the stairs. Elsa takes a quick breath.
Everyone says I may miss Granny now, but it'll pass. I'm not so sure.
The woman looks up at her again with her empathic eyes. Why not?
It hasn't passed for you.
The woman half closes her eyes. Maybe it's different.
How?
Your granny was old.
Not to me. I only knew her for 7 years, almost 8.
The woman doesn't answer. Elsa rubs her hands together like Wolfheart does.
You should come today,
Elsa calls out after her, but the woman has already disappeared. Elsa hears the door of her flat closing and then everything is silent until she hears Dad's voice from the door at the bottom. She collects herself and wipes her tears and forces the worst to hide in the wardrobe again with half of the Moo gun ammunition as a bribe. Then she closes the door of Granny's flat without locking it and runs down the stairs. And a few moments later, she's lying in Audi with the seat reclined as far as it'll go, staring out at the glass ceiling. The cloud animals are soaring lower now. Dad is wearing a suit and is also silent. It feels strange because Dad hardly ever wears a suit, but today is the day.
Do you believe in God, Dad?
Asks Elsa, in the way that always catches him unaware like water balloons thrown from a balcony. Elsa knows that because Granny loved water balloons and Dad learned never to walk right beneath her balcony. I don't know, he answers. Elsa hates him for not having an answer, but she loves him a bit for not lying. Audi stops outside a black steel gate. They sit for a while, waiting.
Am I like Granny?
Says Elsa, without taking her eyes off the sky. You mean in physical appearance? Asks Dad, hesitantly.
No, like as a person, sighs Elsa.
Dad looks as if he's fighting his hesitation for a moment, like you do when you have daughters aged about 8. It's almost as if Elsa has just asked him to explain where babies come from, again. You must stop saying like and sort of all the time. Only people with a bad vocabulary, he begins to say instead, because he can't stop himself, because that's the way he is. One of those who find it very important to say one of those and not one of them.
So bloody leave it then,
Elsa snaps, much more vehemently than she means to, because she's not in the mood for his corrections today. Usually it's their thing, correcting one another, their only thing. Dad has a word jar, where Elsa puts difficult words she has learned, like concise and pretentious, or complex phrases like, my fridge is a taco sauce graveyard, and every time the jar is full, she gets a gift voucher for a book to download on the iPad. The word jar has financed the entire Harry Potter series for her, although she knows Dad is ridiculously dubious about Harry Potter, because Dad can't get his head round a story unless it's based on reality.
Sorry,
mumbles Elsa. Dad sinks into his seat. They compete at seeing who can feel most ashamed. Then he says, slightly less tentatively, yes, you're very much like her. You've got all your best qualities from her and your mother. Elsa doesn't answer because she doesn't know if that was the answer she wanted. Dad doesn't say anything either because he's unsure whether that was what he should have said. Elsa wants to tell him she wants to stay with him more. Every other weekend is not enough. She wants to yell at him that once Harfy comes along and is quite normal, George and Mum won't want to have Elsa at home any more, because parents want normal children, not different children. And Harfy will stand next to Elsa and remind them of all the differences between them. She wants to yell that Granny was wrong, that different is not always good, because different is a mutation, and almost no one in X-Men has a family. She wants to yell out the whole thing, but she doesn't, because she knows he'd never understand. And she knows he wouldn't want her to live with him and Lizette, because Lizette has her own children, undifferent children. Dad sits in silence like you do when you don't feel like wearing a suit. But just as Elsa opens Audi's door to jump out, he turns to her hesitantly and says in a low voice, but there are moments when I sincerely hope that not all your best traits come from Granny and Mum, Elsa. And then Elsa squeezes her eyes together tightly and puts her forehead against his shoulder and her fingers into her jacket pocket and spins the lid of the red felt-tip pen that he gave her when she was small so she could add her own punctuation marks, and which is still the best present he's ever given her, or anyone.
You gave me your words,
she whispers. He tries to blink his pride out of his eyes. She sees that. And she wants to tell him that she lied to him last Friday. That she was the one who sent the SMS from Mum's phone about how he didn't have to pick her up from school. But she doesn't want to disappoint him, so she stays quiet. Because you hardly ever disappoint anybody if you just stay quiet. All almost 8-year-olds know that. Dad kisses her hair. She raises her head and pretends to say in passing,
Will you and Lisette have children?
I don't think so, Dad replies sadly, as if it's quite self-evident.
Why not?
We have all the children we need. And it sounds as if he stops himself from saying, more than we need. Or at least, that's how it feels.
Is it because of me you don't want more children?
She asks, and hopes he'll say, no. Yes, he says.
Because I turned out different,
she whispers. He doesn't answer, and she doesn't wait. But just as she's about to slam the door of Audi from the outside, Dad reaches across the seat and catches her fingertips, and when she meets his eyes, he looks back tentatively, like he always does. But then he whispers,
Because you turned out to be perfect.
She's never heard him so non-tentative, and if she'd said that aloud, he would have told her that there's no such word. And she loves him for that. George stands by the gate looking sad. He's also wearing a suit. Elsa runs past him, and Mum catches hold of her, her mascara running, and Elsa presses her face against Harfi. Mum's dress smells of boutique. The cloud animals are flying low. And that's the day they bury Elsa's granny. Chapter 21 Candle Grease. There are storytellers in the land of almost awake who say we all have an inner voice whispering to us what we must do, and all we must do is listen. Elsa has never really believed it because she doesn't like the thought of someone else having a voice inside her, and Granny always said that only psychologists and murderers have inner voices. Granny never liked proper psychology, though she really did try with the woman in the black skirt. But in spite of all, in a moment, Elsa will hear a voice in her head, as clear as a bell. It won't be whispering, it will be yelling. It will be yelling, run! And Elsa will run for her life, with the shadow behind her. Of course she doesn't know that when she goes into the church. The quiet murmuring of hundreds of strangers rises towards the ceiling, like the hissing of a broken car stereo. The legions of smart asses point at her and whisper. Their eyes are oppressive. She doesn't know who they are, and it makes her feel tricked. She doesn't want to share Granny with others. She doesn't want to be reminded of how Granny was her only friend, while Granny herself had hundreds of others. She concentrates hard on walking straight-backed through the crush, doesn't want them to see that she feels as if she's going to collapse any moment, and doesn't even have the strength to be upset any more. The church floor sucks at her feet. The coffin up there stings her eyes. The mightiest power of death is not that it can make people die, but that it can make the people left behind want to stop living, she thinks, without remembering where she heard that. On second thought, she decides it probably comes from the land of almost awake, although this seems unlikely when one considers what Granny thought about death. Death was Granny's nemesis. That's why she never wanted to talk about it. And that was also why she became a surgeon, to cause death as much aggravation as she could. But it might also come from Miplorus, realizes Elsa. Granny never wanted to ride to Miplorus when they were in the land of almost awake, but sometimes she did it anyway because of Elsa's nagging. And sometimes Elsa rode there on her own when Granny was at some inn in Miamis playing poker with a troll or arguing about wine with a snow angel. Miplorus is the most beautiful of all the kingdoms of the land of almost awake. The trees sing there. The grass massages the soles of your feet, and there's always a smell of fresh baked bread. The houses are so beautiful that to be on the safe side, you have to be sitting down when you look at them. But no one lives there. They're only used for storage. For Miplorus is where all fairy creatures bring their sorrow, and where all leftover sorrow is stored. for an eternity of all fairy tales. People in the real world always say when something terrible happens that the sadness and loss and aching pain of the heart will lessen as time passes. But it isn't true. Sorrow and loss are constant, but if we all had to go through our whole lives carrying them the whole time, we wouldn't be able to stand it. The sadness would paralyze us. So in the end, we just pack it into bags and find somewhere to leave it. That is what Miploris is, a kingdom where lone storytelling travellers come slowly wandering from all directions, dragging unwieldy luggage full of sorrow, a place where they can put it down and go back to life. And when the travellers turn back, they do so with lighter steps, because Miploris is constructed in such a way that irrespective of what direction you leave it, you always have the sun up ahead and the wind at your back. The Miplorisians gather up all the suitcases and sacks and bags of sorrow and carefully make a note of them in little pads. They scrupulously catalogue every kind of sadness and pining. Things are kept in very good order in Miploris. They have an extensive system of rules and impeccably clear areas of responsibility for all kinds of sorrows.
"Bureaucratic bastards," was what Granny called the Miplorisians, because of all the forms that have to be filled out nowadays by whoever is dropping off some sorrow or other. "But you can't put up with this order when it comes to sorrow," say the Miplorisians.
Miploris used to be the smallest kingdom in the land of Almost Awake, but after the war without end it became the biggest. That was why Granny didn't like riding there, because so many of the stores had her name on signs outside. And in Miploris people talk of inner voices. Elsa remembers now. Miplorisians believe that the inner voices are those of the dead, coming back to help their loved ones. Elsa is pulled back into the real world by Dad's gentle hand on her shoulder. She hears his voice whispering, "You've arranged everything very nicely, Ulrika," to Mum. In the corner of her eye she sees how Mum smiles and nods at the programmes lying on the church pews, and then replies, "Thanks for doing the programmes. Lovely font." Elsa sits at the far end of the wooden pew at the front of the chapel, staring down into the floor until the mumbling dies down. The church is so packed that people are standing all along the walls. Many of them have insanely weird clothes, as if they've been playing outfit roulette with someone who can't read washing instruction tags. Elsa will put "outfit roulette" in the word jar, she thinks. She tries to focus on that thought. But she hears languages she can't understand, and she hears her name being squeezed into strange pronunciations, and this takes her back to reality. She sees strangers pointing at her with varying degrees of discretion. She understands that they all know who she is, and it makes her mad, so that when she glimpses a familiar face along one of the walls, she has trouble placing him at first. Like when you see a celebrity in a cafe and instinctively burst out, "Oh, hi there," before you realise that your brain has had time to tell you, "Hey, that's probably someone you know, say hi," but not, "No, wait, it's just that guy from the TV," because your brain likes to make you look an idiot. His face disappears behind a shoulder for a few moments, but when he reappears, he's looking right at Elsa. It's the accountant who came to speak about the leasehold conversion yesterday. But he's dressed as a priest now. He winks at her. Another priest starts talking about Granny, then about God, but Elsa doesn't listen. She wonders if this is what Granny would have wanted. She's not sure that Granny liked church so very much. Granny and Elsa hardly ever talked about God, because Granny associated God with death. And this is all fake, plastic, and makeup. As if everything's going to be fine just because they're having a funeral. Everything is not going to be fine for Elsa, she knows that. She breaks into a cold sweat. A couple of the strangers in the weird clothes come up to the microphone and talk. Some of them do so in other languages, and have a little lady who translates into another microphone. But no one says dead. Everyone just says that Granny has passed away, or that they've lost her, as if she's a sock that's been lost in the tumble dryer. A few of them are crying, but she doesn't think they have the right, because she wasn't their Granny, and they have no right to make Elsa feel as if Granny had other countries and kingdoms to which she never brought Elsa. So when a fat lady who looks like she's combed her hair with a toaster starts reading poems, Elsa thinks it's just about enough, and she pushes her way out between the pews. She hears Mum whispering something behind her, but she just shuffles along the shiny stone floor and squeezes out of the church doors before anyone has time to come after her. The winter air bites at Elsa. It feels like she's being yanked out of a boiling hot bath by her hair. The cloud animals are hovering low and ominous. Elsa walks slowly and takes such deep breaths of the December air that her eyes start to black out. She thinks about Storm. Storm has always been one of Elsa's favourite superheroes, because Storm's superpower is that she can change the weather. Even Granny used to admit that as superpowers went, that one was pretty cool. Elsa hopes that Storm will come and blow away this whole bloody church. The whole bloody churchyard, bloody everything. The faces from inside spiral round inside her head. Did she really see the accountant? Was Alf standing in there? She thinks so. She saw another face she recognised, the policewoman with the green eyes. She walks faster, away from the church, because she doesn't want any of them to come after her and ask if she's okay. Because she's not okay. None of this will ever be okay. She doesn't want to listen to their mumbling or have to admit that they are talking about her. Over her, around her. Granny never talked around her. She's gone about 50 meters between the headstones when she picks up a smell of smoke. At first there's something familiar about it, something almost liberating. Something that Elsa wants to turn round to and embrace and bury her nose in, like a freshly laundered pillowcase on a Sunday morning. But then there's something else. And her inner voice comes to her. She knows where the man between the headstones is before she's even turned round. He's only a few meters away from her, casually holding his cigarette between his fingertips. It's too far from the church for anyone to hear Elsa scream, and with calm, cold movements, he blocks her way back. Elsa glances over her shoulder towards the gate, 20 meters away. When she looks back, he's taken a long stride towards her, and the inner voice comes to Elsa. And it's Granny's voice, but it isn't whispering, it's yelling. Run! Elsa feels his rough hand grasping her arm, but she slips out of his grip. She runs until the wind scrapes her eyes like nails against a frosty windscreen. She doesn't know for how long, eternities, and when the memory of his eyes and his cigarette crystallizes in her brain, when every breath punches into her lungs, she realizes that he was limping. That's why she got away. Another second of hesitation, and he would have grabbed her by her dress, but Elsa is too used to running, too good at it. She runs until she's no longer sure whether it's the wind or her grief that is making her eyes run. Runs until she realizes she's almost at her school. She slows down, looks round, hesitates, then she charges right into the black park on the other side of the street, with her dress tossing around her. Even the trees look like enemies in there. The sun seems too exhausted to go down. She hears scattered voices, the wind screaming through the branches, the rumbling of traffic further and further away. Out of breath and furious, she stumbles towards the interior of the park, hears voices, hears that some of them are calling out after her. "Hey, little girl," they call out. She stops, exhausted, collapses on a bench, hears the "little girl" voice coming closer. She understands that it means her harm. The park seems to be creeping under a blanket. She hears another voice beside the first, slurring and stumbling over its words as if it's put on its shoes the wrong way round. Both of the voices seem to be picking up speed as they come towards her. Realizing the danger, she's on her feet and running in a fluid movement. They follow. It dawns on her with sudden despair that the winter gloom is making everything look the same in the park, and she doesn't know the way out. Good God, she's a 7-year-old girl who watches television a hell of a lot. How could she be so stupid? This is how people end up on the sides of milk cartons, or however they advertise missing children these days. But it's too late. She runs between two dense black hedges that form a narrow corridor, and she feels her beating heart in her throat. She doesn't know why she charged into the park. The junkies will get her, just as everyone at school said they would. Maybe that's just it, she thinks to herself. Maybe she wants someone to catch her and kill her. Death's greatest power is not that it can make people die, but that it can make people want to stop living. She never hears the snapping of branches in the bush, never hears the ice being crushed under his feet. But in an instant, the slurring voices behind her are gone. Her eardrums grate until she wants to scream, and then everything goes back to silence. Slowly, she's lifted off the ground, closes her eyes, doesn't open them until she's been carried out of the park. Wolfart stares down at her. She stares back, lying in his arms. Her consciousness seems to float off. If it wasn't for the realization in some part of her inner self that there aren't enough paper bags in the whole world to breathe into if she dribbles on Wolfart in her sleep, she would probably have gone to sleep there and then. So she struggles to stay awake, and after all, it would be a bit impolite to go to sleep now that he's saved her. Again.
Not run alone. Never run alone, growls Wolfart.
She's still not quite sure if she wanted to be saved, although she's happy to see him. Happier than she expected to be, actually. She thought she'd be angrier at him.
Dangerous place, growls Wolfart, towards the park, and starts putting her back down on the ground.
I know, she mumbles.
Never again, he orders, and she can hear that he's afraid.
She puts her arms round his neck and whispers, "Thanks," in the secret language, before he can straighten up his enormous body. Then she sees how uncomfortable it makes him, and she lets go at once.
"I wash my hands really carefully. I had a mega long shower this morning," she whispers.
Wolfart doesn't answer, but she can see in his eyes that he'll be like bathing in Alka-Gel when he gets home. Elsa looks around. Wolfart rubs his hands together and shakes his head when he notices.
"Gone now," he says gently.
Elsa nods.
"How did you know I was here?"
Wolfart's gaze drops into the asphalt.
"Guard you. Your granny said guard you."
Elsa nods.
"Even if I don't always know you're close by?"
Wolfheart's hood moves up and down. She feels that her legs are about to give way beneath her.
"Why did you disappear?"
she whispers accusingly.
"Why did you leave me with that therapist?"
Wolfheart's face disappears under his hood.
"Psychologists want to talk, always talk, about war, always. I don't want to."
"Maybe you'd feel better if you talked."
Wolfart rubs his hands together in silence. He watches the street as if waiting to catch sight of something. Elsa wraps her arms round her body and realizes that she left both her jacket and her Gryffindor scarf in the church. It's the only time she's ever forgotten her Gryffindor scarf. Who the hell would forget a Gryffindor scarf? She also looks up and down the street, searching for she doesn't know what. Then she feels something being swept over her shoulders, and when she turns round she realizes that Wolfheart has put his coat round her. It drags along the ground by her feet, smells of detergent. It's the first time she's seen Wolfheart without the upturned hood. Oddly enough, he looks even bigger without it. His long hair and black beard billow in the wind.
"You said Miamis means I love in your mother's language, right?"
asks Elsa, and tries not to look directly at his scar, because she can see he rubs his hands even harder when she does. He nods, scans the street.
"What does Miploris mean?" asks Elsa.
When he doesn't answer at first, she assumes it's because he doesn't understand the question, so she clarifies.
One of the six kingdoms in the land of Almost Awake is called Miploris. That's where all the sorrow is stored. Granny never wanted to...
Wolfhard interrupts her, but gently. I mourn. Elsa nods.
And Merevus?
I dream.
And Meodacus?
I dare.
And Mimovus?
Dance. I dance. Elsa lets the words touch down inside her before she asks about the last kingdom. She thinks about what Granny always said about Wolfhard, that he was the invincible warrior who defeated the shadows, and that only he could have done it, because he had the heart of a warrior and the soul of a storyteller. Because he was born in Myamis, but he grew up in Mybatalos.
What does Mybatalos mean? She asks.
He looks right at her when she asks that, with those big dark eyes wide open with everything that is kept in Miploris. Mybatalos. I fight. Mybatalos. Gone now. No Mybatalos anymore.
I know. The shadows destroyed it in the war without end, and all the Mybatalosians died except you, for you are the last of your people, and...
Elsa starts saying, but Wolfhart rubs his hands together so hard that she stops herself. Wolfhart's hair falls into his face. He backs away a step.
Mybatalos not exist. I don't fight. Never more fight.
And Elsa understands. The way you always understand such things when you see them in the eyes of those saying them, that he did not hide in the forests at the far reaches of the land of Almost Awake because he was afraid of the shadows, but because he was afraid of himself, afraid of what they made him into in Mybatalos. His eyes flip past her, and she hears Alf's voice. When she spins round, Taxi is parked with its engine running by the edge of the pavement. Alf's shoes shuffle through the snow. The policewoman stays by Taxi, her eyes making rapid hawk-like sweeps over the park. When Alf picks up Elsa, still rolled up in Wolfhart's sleeping bag-sized coat, he says calmly, "Let's get you home now, shall we? You can't bloody stay here getting frozen." But Elsa hears in his voice that he's afraid, afraid as one can only be if one knows what was chasing Elsa in the churchyard. And she can tell by the watchful gaze in the policewoman's green eyes that she also knows.
They all know more than they're letting on.
Elsa doesn't look round as Alf carries her back towards Taxi. She knows that Wolfhart has already gone. And when she throws herself into Mum's arms back at the church, she also knows that Mum knows more than she's letting on. And she's always known more than she lets on. Elsa thinks about the story of the Lionheart brothers, about the dragon, Catla, who could not be defeated by any human, and about the terrible constrictor snake, Calm, the only one that could destroy Catla in the end. Because sometimes in the tales, the only thing that can destroy a terrible dragon is something even more terrible than the dragon. A monster. Chapter 22. Oh Boy. Elsa has been chased hundreds of times before, but never like in that churchyard. And the fear she feels now is something else, because she had time to see his eyes just before she ran, and they looked so determined, so cold, like he was ready to kill her. That's a lot for an almost 8-year-old to handle. Elsa tried never to be afraid while Granny was alive. Or at least she tried never to show it, because Granny hated fears. Fears are small, fiery creatures from the land of Almost Awake, with rough pelts that coincidentally look quite a lot like blue tumble-dryer fluff, and if you give them the slightest opportunity, they jump up and nibble your skin and try to scratch your eyes. Fears are like cigarettes, said Granny. The hard thing isn't stopping, it's not starting. It was the Nowween who brought the fears to the land of Almost Awake, in another of Granny's tales, more eternities ago than anyone could really count. So long ago that at the time there were only 5 kingdoms, not 6. The Nauin is a prehistoric monster that wants everything to happen immediately. Every time a child says, in a minute, or later, or I'm just going to, the Nauin bellows with furious force.
No, it has to be done now!
The Nauin hates children, because children refuse to accept the Nauin's lie that time is linear. Children know that time is just an emotion, so now is a meaningless word to them, just as it was for Granny. George used to say that Granny wasn't a time optimist, she was a time atheist, and the only religion she believed in was do-it-later Buddhism. The Nauin brought the fears to the land of Almost Awake to catch children, because when a Nauin gets hold of a child, it engulfs the child's future, leaving the victim helpless where it is, facing an entire life of eating now and sleeping now and tidying up right away. Never again can the child postpone something boring till later and do something fun in the meantime. All that's left is now. A fate far worse than death, Granny always said. So the tale of the Nauin started by clarifying that it hated fairy tales. Because nothing is better at making a child postpone something than a fairy tale. So one night, the Nauin slithered up, Telling Mountain, the highest mountain peak in the land of Almost Awake, where it caused a massive landslide, which demolished the entire peak. Then it lay in wait in a dark cave. For Telling Mountain is the mountain the enfants have to climb in order to be able to release the tales so they can glide over into the real world. And if the tales can't leave Telling Mountain, the whole kingdom of Miamis will suffocate, and then the whole land of Almost Awake will suffocate, for no stories can live without children listening to them. When dawn came, all the bravest fighters from Mibatalos tried to climb the mountain and defeat the Nauin, but no one managed it, because the Nauin was breeding fears in the caves. Fears need to be handled carefully, because threats just make them grow bigger. So every time a parent somewhere threatened a child, it worked as fertilizer. Soon, a child said somewhere, and then a parent yelled,
No, now, or I'll...
And bang, another fear was hatched in one of the Nauin's caves. When the warriors from Mibatalos came up the mountain, the Nauin released the fears, and they immediately transformed themselves into each individual soldier's worst nightmare. For all beings have a mortal fear, even the warriors from Mibatalos, and the air in the land of Almost Awake slowly grew thinner. Storytellers found it increasingly difficult to breathe. Elsa obviously interrupted Granny at this point because her whole thing about fears transforming themselves into what you are most afraid of was actually nicked from Harry Potter, because that's how a boggart works. And then Granny had snorted and answered, Maybe it's that Harry Muppet who nicked it from me. And then Elsa had sneered, Harry Potter doesn't steal. And then they'd argued for quite a long time about that, and in the end Granny gave up and mumbled, Fine then, forget the whole bloody thing. Fears don't transform themselves, they just bite and try to scratch your eyes. Are you satisfied now or what? And then Elsa had left it there, and they went on with the story. That's when the two golden knights showed up. Everyone tried to warn them about riding up the mountain, but they didn't listen, of course. Knights can be so damned obstinate. But when they came up the mountain and all the fears welled out of the caves, the golden knights didn't fight. They didn't yell and swear, as other warriors would have done. Instead, the knights did the only thing you can do with fears. They laughed at them. Loud, defiant laughter. And then all the fears were turned to stone, one by one. Granny was fond of rounding off fairy tales with things being turned to stone because she wasn't very good at endings. Elsa never complained, though. The Nauin was obviously put in prison for an indeterminate length of time, which made it insanely angry. And the ruling council of the Land of Almost Awake decided to appoint a small group of inhabitants from each of the kingdoms. Warriors from Mibatalos, and dream hunters from Miravis, and sorrow keepers from Miploris, and musicians from Mimovas, and storytellers from Miamis, to keep guard over Telling Mountain. The stones of the fears were used to rebuild the peak higher than ever, and at the foot of the mountain, the sixth kingdom was built, Meordakis. And in the fields of Meordakis, courage was cultivated, so that no one would ever again have to be afraid of the fears.
Oh, well, that is what they did until, as Granny once told Elsa, after the harvest, they took all the courage plants and made a special drink of them. And if you had some of it, you became incredibly brave.
And then Elsa did a bit of